The defense in this matter basically broke him, and along with his farming activities, which led to this. And once we finished the trial, he was out of money, so I had to withdraw, and then the court appointed me as his counsel for the appeal. Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Kerry Underwood.
Counsel.
And I'm proud here to be here today to represent Dr. Daniel Crook. I represented Dr. Crook years civilly and count him as a friend. And I think in this case what happened is that the jury was overwhelmed by the numbers and the calculations on the rice counts. And they were also overwhelmed and confused by the sheer volume on the equipment counts, all these papers that had been signed. And how could Dr. Crook have missed all of this rice? How could Dr. Crook have not known that the FSA had the first mortgage? And I think that confusion was compounded by the jury not, number one, not hearing the whole story and how these things work, and number two, by the jury hearing evidence that they should not have on other acts. And if the court permits, I'd like to first address the equipment counts and basically lump in issues, I think it's 3 through 6, on all of the banking issues. One is the banking expert, one is the jury instruction, one is the banking witness, and one are the bank documents. And they really all fall into the same analysis. Dr. Crook, despite signing hundreds of pages of documents on these loans and security agreements and collateral, was never given the one most important piece of paper in the whole proceedings, and that was the assignment by the bank to the FSA of their first rights. These were UCC filings, I think exhibits 29 and 30 in the record, where the bank says, all right, FSA, in exchange for this money you're giving us, we're transferring our rights to you, and you now have first rights and we're second fiddle. There was no testimony by any bank person, by any FSA person, that Dr. Crook ever received this notice. The clerk of court.
Well, of course, the government's response to that is that even if he didn't know that the bank's rights were subordinate to the FSA, he was still required to give the FSA notice before he sold or disposed of the collateral. So what's your answer to that?
That's where it gets to the lit law, Judge. What Dr. Crook was entitled to do if the bank was still first, under Louisiana law, is to pay the bank until he got that notice. Just simply not giving the FSA notice, hey, I'm fixing to sell this collateral, and give the money to the first lien holder of the bank, there's nothing going to be left over for you. There's no harm, no foul. If the bank is actually first in line, the FSA really doesn't have a say in the matter. Yes, should he have notified them? Sure he should have, but that's not criminal.
Well, why didn't the bank tell him?
That is what the jury did not hear, Your Honor. Without Tom Casey, the main man, and those bank documents, it shows, and our whole argument was lack of intent, it shows with the bank that the bank even got confused. The bank at one point, with these documents that were kept out, said that, well, we thought we were the first. We were actually the second. Even the bank thought this.
Well, I don't understand. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. And when the bank discovered it, they chose not to tell Dr. Crook, and they even put that in their own documents that we're not going to cure this misconception.
Now, where's that in the evidence?
That is in proffers 1 and 2.
Proffers? Why? Okay.
Proffers 1 and 2. Those are the bank documents on issue number 6, exhibits 42 and 45. And this dovetails into the banking expert, Your Honor. This banking expert has handled these farm loans all his life. We're from a rural area. And what happens is these farmers come in, and usually they don't know who has first on what, and they come in and they pay, sell this collateral and they pay it. What the bank is supposed to do legally is if they're not a first, they're supposed to give the money to the first mortgage holder, the FSA. The bank did not. And Dr. Crook didn't keep a penny of this money.
Did the bank apply that to other loans, or did they apply it to equipment loans, or what?
They applied it to his farm loan, which was collateralized by the equipment. And the FSA had the emergency loan, which is different from the bank loan, and so it was never applied to that one.
Well, surely, I mean, as you say, this is a rural area, and they're cut. I mean, as far as I can tell from another case I've had, Congress passes these disaster programs nearly every year. So people should be familiar. Had Dr. Crook applied for this kind of loan in the past?
He never applied. There are two different things here. There's a disaster assistance program where they give them money.
Right.
That's not a loan. And then there's an emergency loan program where they loan them money. He had never applied for an emergency loan before. This was his first time. And throughout his entire farming career, he'd always gotten loans from the bank. The bank always had the first lien, and he thought it was the same throughout.
I mean, you had him testify extensively to this.
Yes.
And then your closing argument was right on the money, just what you're telling us now. So this ties back into, you could say the jury was confused, but what Dr. Crook testifies and says he didn't look at the fine print, right? And then Mr. Flint did say what he said about Crook probably having looked at stuff. And then Dr. Crook says Miss Davies might have been programmed by the agent. That just all goes into the grist, doesn't it? And so I guess I'm
that
wondering
programming comment was the worst.
It was the worst, and that'll kill you at trial. But he made that comment, so it throws it into the world of credibility. And since you effectively did get a complete good faith instruction, what I guess my question to you is, it's a compelling argument, your case, and the trial seemed quite close on counts 3 to 8. But ultimately, how does it connect to a legal error? Or is this just you saying not sufficient evidence? Which of your errors does it connect to?
It's both. It's
I know, but pick your best one so I can see, right? Because we can go through them all. I didn't see a cumulative final argument saying all these interlocking.
Well, and that's what I'm talking here. Is
I know.
They're all together.
But did you make a cumulative argument in your briefs? Saying maybe not individually each error, but all together, yes?
I'm not sure if I did on the appellate one. I did on the motion for new trial at the end of every one. That's my normal.
Because if you go one by one, I think when you do get a good faith instruction, our law says that pretty much subsumes, right? You see that point? And then on.
Well, they excluded the bank evidence.
Right, and I agree.
You want to start there, the bank evidence?
One by one. Well, I think they all are together because okay. It's the bank witness, the bank documents, the jury instruction on the
right.
Bank law and the bank expert.
I know, but we sort of have to go one by one to see if there's even error. Do you want to start with the excluded bank records? Because your comment is that those are not hearsay because they reflect the state of mind of your client. Is that correct?
Well, and also Tom Casey is the man who, from
right,
the bank,
that's a separate
who would
issue.
Have been...
You want to talk about Tom Casey first? Which of the various alleged errors do you want to really hit home on?
Whichever one you would like to hear.
I'm asking you to start with what you think your strongest is, because we're
okay.
Prepared for each one, but it's hard to know.
Certainly. My strongest argument is the cumulative effect of
okay.
all of those
but you didn't put that
errors
in as
together,
a, all right.
Your Honor, is the banking expert, the banking law, the banking documents, and the banking witness.
Okay, I'm going to ask one more time. You pick one to begin with.
All right. The one I would like to begin with is the jury instruction, Your Honor.
Okay.
The jury instruction, it accurately states the law, no question. It was not given in the charge, no question.
But, you say no question, but what about the good faith instruction subsuming it? Because basically it's a statement of Louisiana law, just as the government appeared to ask for one also. And then the district judge here says, ladies and gentlemen, even if he's wrong on Louisiana law, it is a complete defense. How does that not absorb your instruction?
Your Honor, if I'm a juror and I'm told that the law provides Dr. Crook to do exactly what he did, is pay the bank if he didn't get notice of this assignment, that is heavy, heavy weight that leads to whether or not Dr.
Yeah.
Crook's credible and
but,
his intent.
But the government wouldn't have maybe I'm wrong, we'll hear from the government. I thought the argument wasn't that he couldn't pay the bank, it was that he had to notify that it was defrauding FSA if he disposed of that collateral without notifying them, whether he can pay the bank or not.
That dovetails back to intent, Your Honor, and in the defrauding. The lack of notice is not per se fraud. The lack of notice is, have to be fraudulent that he didn't notify him because he's trying to scheme somebody.
If you pay off the first lien holder, you're never in a criminal violation as to the second lien holder.
Correct.
Because the first lien holder, he who has the gold hat, makes the rules, and the first lien holder is, so the question is whether the man legitimately thought the bank was still the first lien holder.
That's correct, Your Honor. And for a jury to properly to determine that, I think they needed all of this other evidence that they were not given. Is how these normally work.
The bank
work.
Kept the money.
Sure, sure, that's correct. And the banker they were never told that was wrong.
And if that's correct, I mean, the bank are his friends, right? I assume it's a small community.
Well, this fellow's from Arizona, Tom Casey. He was not his friend. And this was a national bank at the time and not a little local bank. But that's to me, the jury never heard that, Your Honor. The jury never heard that, well, this is what normally happens, and they pay this money, and it goes to whoever rightfully gets it.
So did you made some passing reference to the idea that the government was still over-collateralized on equipment?
On page
yes.
53, you say that.
The evidence showed what they did was they took this collateral, and on each loan there's two entities, Crook Foreign Partnership and Crook Planning Company. And I get confused every time over the two. But I studied up on it since I get confused. But Crook Foreign Partnership is the one where he was just had a power of attorney. Crook Planning Company was one where Dr. Crook was a partner. But they took the entire collateral and they applied it to each emergency loan. When you look at the collateral list and you look at the UCC filings and you add up everything that they had, there's $1 million something on the collateral. And when you go and you look at that, and you see at the end of the day how much collateral was left, even when you take away what they said was sold and he didn't tell us about, they were fully collateralized based on the values that they had.
Did you prove that? I mean, did you have
yes,
that in evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. That's in the evidence and that is in the record that was all there. And actually, in fact, in sentencing, of course, now, years later, the collateral was worth less, but in sentencing, they sold a bunch of it, and of course it drove down the numbers for the sentencing guidelines. But here you have a man, it's not like he pocketed this money. He paid, what it mattered to him which creditor got the money. He paid who he thought was first.
Well, now the government says at the end of their brief that in fact these farms were failing, and so he had a reason to pay off the bank first.
The farms were failing, no question. In 2005, I don't know why he has a reason to pay off the bank first, though, because he owes $100 here and $100 here. If you pay the bank $50, you still owe $150 cumulative. I don't see where it matters where he paid the $50. He's
well,
got the same debt regardless.
Normally, people like that will pay off who their guarantee is.
Who their guarantee?
They pay off the creditor to whom they've given a personal guarantee.
I'm not sure whether he gave the bank a
that's
personal guarantee, but I imagine, that's normally the case in these farming situations.
Do they do that in the emergency loan? Do they give a personal guarantee in the emergency loan?
There were also UCC filings for Dr. Crook personally. I don't know that he had a guarantee of the whole amount, but he's on the hook as a partner. Every partner in the farming,
right. Whatever,
if they get a tax refund,
right, but that
it's
partnership,
taken.
He would have been less liable on that partnership, right, because that was a smaller acreage, wasn't it? Or was that?
I believe they're each responsible for the whole,
Oh. Even
though they're partners. And okay. That's why they were getting his dad Social Security benefits and this, that, and other to try to pay off these things. So whatever federal benefit they had, it went to them. Quickly on the Rice counts, since we haven't discussed them at all. The confusion with the jury on the Rice counts was where was this Rice farm? That was the biggest thing, is where was this Rice farm? If you took, as the government said, all that 45,000 hundredweight, however much it is a lot of rice, and did it only to Crook Farms Partnership? Yes, that would have been a huge gap. But in reality here, what happened, there's no question, there was a horrible disaster. This crop that Crook Farms Partnership had was horrible. There's no way they could have produced that much rice. And when you boil it down and look to those facts and not get confused by everything else, this was not a huge underreporting, if an underreporting at all. But we're never going to be able to go and get to the kernel of rice, or whatever you call one thing
grain.
Of rice, grain of rice, the exact figures, because these tickets were wrong. and we can't go back and do exactly what it was. So I've got a lot more in the brief on the rice, and I'm going to save the other time for rebuttal.
You're not relying so much on the idea that this new manager had messed up on the figures?
Oh, that's totally it. But I think the jury thought, well, how could he miss this much rice? Even if the manager screwed up, you should have known, Dr. Crook, that this rice was missing. And when you get down to it, there wasn't that much rice missing. But no, Philip Civils totally owned the mistake. He did all the calculations. He filled out all the documents. He said, it's my bad, my mistake. And Dr. Crook, who was busy can be, simply relied on what his employee did. That certainly was the case, but the jury didn't buy it for whatever reason.
Okay. You have time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Cassier, this is a very troubling case to me, irrespective of what the legal issues suggest. Why did it take the government 10 years to indict this man? Why is he indicted on counts that I've, in my many years on the bench, have never seen the government charge a person with selling collateral out from under a loan, particularly if the government remained over-collateralized?
Well, Your Honor, we have charged and we have prosecuted individuals for selling property out from under their collateral agreements with the government in the past, and perhaps they never made it to appeal, but we have done that, and that is the case here. This particular case, as for the length of time, I do not know. I believe there was something to do with
audits. Well, you basically ruin a man's life. I mean, it's one thing to just go after him for cheating the government, but when it's prolonged over 10 years, you basically ruin their lives.
Well, Your Honor, the evidence at trial was not as cut and dry as defense counsel would have it be. There was abundant evidence from the various FSA loan individuals and representatives from the FSA concerning his applications for the loans. And the loan applications were admitted into evidence, and each one was signed by defendant, and on them there is a stipulation that says he will give FSA notice. Pardon me. That he will notify FSA before he disposes of any collateral, or I believe it even exchanges any of the collateral that he has given. He also, on many of them, said that there was no prior lien elsewhere. In fact, as far as the FSA knew, the only prior lien on any of this equipment was a John Deere. John Deere had a lien on some tractor or combine, I believe. And that is the only lien that the FSA was made aware of at the time that he made application for the loans. This defendant is not illiterate, and he was not a total absentee farmer. He had the power of attorney for Crook Farm Partnership, even though he was not a member of that partnership. It was made up of his father, a cousin, and I believe a brother. And those individuals, the FSA representative said, they never met them. They dealt mainly with Crook and his farm manager, Civils. Civils testified that he would not take any action to pledge any equipment that was in a defendant's individual name without defendant's approval. Civils also testified he did not even know about the gin and the airplane at the time that they were pledged.
Which are not subjects of the indictment.
Which, that is correct, they are not subject to the indictment.
But is it correct or not correct that the government remained over-collateralized?
Your Honor, I do not recall if they were over-collateralized.
That is important. They say at page 53 of his brief, he goes through the numbers, and your brief doesn't address that top, side, or bottom.
I did not think it was that important that they were over-collateralized, Your Honor.
Why would he pay the bank? I mean, how many people who sell collateral out from under a security agreement do it to pay off another creditor?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question.
How many people who the government indicts for selling collateral out from under a security agreement pay off another creditor? In other words, they don't pocket the money for themselves or live the high life or go out and buy grain to plant the next year's crops. They
Well, I don't know about others, but I do know that there was testimony from the individual who Dr. Crook had going out to sell this equipment, and this individual testified at trial that Dr. Crook said to him that the FSA and the bank had liens on this property and that he didn't care about the FSA. He wanted to pay off the bank to get the bank off his back. And the reason why he wanted to get the bank off his back is because the interest rate was very high at the bank. And I don't know about the personal guarantee that he may have had on there, but the interest rate was very high, whereas the FSA loan, the disaster loan, was considerably lower. I think it was like 3.5%, and the interest rate at the bank was approaching 20%. So that would be quite an incentive.
Was that in evidence?
Pardon?
And that was in evidence, what you just said?
Yes.
I didn't remember that.
And the essence of this offense, or of the trial, came down to, do we believe Dr. Crook or do we believe the government's
evidence? Did you make
any
effort against the bank to get the money back from the bank? Did you make any effort to get the money back from the bank? Did FSA make
it? It sounds like they're a co-conspirator, really.
I do not know what efforts have been made for recovery. I know that I believe there is a restitution order, but I don't know what efforts have been made for recovery.
I mean, if the bank assigned its position to the FSA, which is the which is what he says, then the bank should have known, or was certainly on notice, that it didn't have the first interest anymore.
Your Honor, the district judge addressed this issue as to the knowledge that the bank had or didn't have or didn't give to defendant, as saying that that was irrelevant to defendant's knowledge. The bank's knowledge was not relevant to what defendant knew or should have or intended.
Well, ordinarily I'd agree with that, of course, but I mean, his argument is his credibility. Did he have reason to think that the bank had a first lien? And if the bank never didn't remind him that it, I mean, how's he supposed to know that if he didn't have the financing statement where it had been transferred? I mean, your whole argument now is resting on the knowledge that he should have notified the FSA. But what he's saying is, I thought they were a subordinate creditor.
Well, Your Honor, when he put this equipment up for sale, he stated there were no liens on it, not to anyone, bank or FSA. He could not honestly have said that.
And there is
testimony to that effect.
Yes.
In fact, I believe one of the notices is actually in evidence.
But then he goes and pays off a creditor.
And the reason he did that was precisely what the man who was charged with selling all this stuff at auction and at various places is, because he didn't care about the FSA, he cared about the bank. Interest rate was high and perhaps a personal guarantee. I don't know. That was not in evidence that I recall.
Well, again, I still don't see, I mean, it seems to me that what the bank told him or didn't tell him about the status of this loan would have a bearing on his state of mind.
Well, Your Honor, he went to the FSA.
And you kept all that evidence out?
The only evidence that's out, the two proffers are replete with hearsay. And a lot of it comes directly from defendant.
And
it's self-serving hearsay. And that was the basis on which the government didn't put them in. They were originally, those two exhibits, 42 and 45, were originally in the government's list of exhibits. The government elected not to put them in and elected not to put Tom Casey on.
Those would come in. They wouldn't come in as a statement of a party opponent because he's offering them. But they would come in for the non-hearsay purpose of showing his state of mind, which is his defense, right?
Your Honor, they
it's
were...
It's not the bank's state of mind, which is where the court got a little confused. It would reflect his own state of mind. It wouldn't be admissible for the truth.
At a time when he was committing the crime. He had every reason to be.
He may have, and you could argue that. I'm just not sure you can keep them out. I don't see why you can call them hearsay if they aren't being used for a hearsay.
There was other hearsay in there in addition to that.
Well, then you redact it.
And those.
Here's my.
Well, that was not offered as an option.
I mean,
and
here's my view. I mean, we're talking about counts 3 to 8, and I didn't see a cumulative argument being made, but one's being made orally. And what happens here is the expert is excluded completely, the gentleman that would be able to elaborate about who had the right lien and what obligations are owed. Then the bank officer that he dealt with can't show up. Again, government may have clean hands. Mm-hmm. They may say it's now an ineffectiveness claim. On top of that, the documents that reflect his state of mind as to lien holders happen to be kept out. And when you put all of those together, experts excluded completely, bank officer not available, jury instruction on this defense not given, it becomes sort of a lethal mix.
Your Honor, all four of those issues, granted, go to knowledge and intent, but none of them were admissible. Each piece the judge went through, and these were argued before trial and during trial, as well as in motion for new trial.
But look at the legal, I mean, think about the legal issue. For example, frankly, I thought the hardest issue for me legally was the expert, because the district judge jumps and the government endorses it to complete exclusion of an expert witness. And that implicates, you know, that's a very high standard. I don't see that in this record. What the government is saying is that arraignment, a general request for a reciprocal discovery, triggered the expert summary report. Just a vague general request, right? Because if I look back at the record, it's not going to say, give me that expert summary report.
No.
No, it doesn't. And based on that, the government says preclude the expert altogether for a defense witness.
Because much of his testimony would not have been admissible, and the judge went through that.
But that's not why the court kept it out. The court just says one sentence about it might not have been admissible. But the court kept this expert off the stand because discovery hadn't been complied with. And I think the Supreme Court has said you've got to show willful violation, in as different from my lawyer was sick and he couldn't quite comply. You've got to do lesser sanctions.
Well, Your Honor, I call your attention to a case that just was published by the Fifth Circuit last week, U.S. versus Lundy.
Okay.
The court upheld the exclusion of the expert on a Rule 16 violation. And
it wasn't willful? It was just accidental? Because here we
it
have.
It was, Your Honor, there was no finding of willfulness at all.
All right. What's the citation?
It is number 10-60986. Was just published last week, I think last Thursday or whatever March 28th was.
Okay. I'll look at it.
Well, but the point is, though, that now you also just suggested that the expert didn't have anything useful to contribute, but that's entirely separate. If that's so, then you knew what he was going to say. And so insisting on the report and excluding him because of the lack of report seems even less
The defendant
appealing.
Said what he was going to say. I mean, that was his argument, was he presented what this witness was going to testify about, and that was the lien law in Louisiana, and the judge deemed that irrelevant to defendant's intent or knowledge at the time.
I don't agree with
that. Reference to the
offense. I just flat don't agree with that.
Well, Your Honor, the judge gave very cogent reasons for it in both his ruling at trial and in his ruling on the motion for new trial, and those are there, and the government agrees with them.
Yeah.
But the other piece to this same puzzle, just because it's a lot coming at you, is then we get a very aggressive use of 404B, and looking at the cross-examination of Dr. Crook, there was an enormous amount. I agree, once he says it was a mistake, I don't have intent, then you complied with 404B. You gave notice, the balancing was done. I think Huddleston's met. But yet again, it's all coming together against counts 3 to 8.
Defendant admitted everything in counts 3 to 8 except his intent.
Yeah, that's true. He did. He said, I paid the bank, I didn't pay FSA a single cent.
And I didn't give him notice. He says that.
Right.
And he says what he did. He authorized the sale. The Tuberville, I think was the guy's name, would not have sold this property. And the gin equipment was advertised in Mississippi.
Did you put anyone on from FSA that said that's a material? That the fact that you did, let's say the bank had a first lien. would FSA's testimony have been that just not notifying us of your paying a first lien holder?
That was the charge, that he did not notify. What is this?
I guess that's my question, because I'm not familiar with, what is it, 658? Yeah, 658. I doubt we have pattern instructions on that. Maybe be very specific, because my colleague is saying that you couldn't have made it a crime, just that he didn't notify.
Well, I didn't say that, but he was indicted for...
saying just that he didn't pay.
He was indicted for not paying.
Is that correct?
No, Your Honor, he was indicted for not giving notice.
This is very important. The charging language for 658, because he clearly didn't give notice, but he also clearly thought, well, I shouldn't say clearly, the jury may have disbelieved.
I'll take your word for it, Ms. Cassier, because I'm sure you know it better than I do.
Disposed of it without permission.
That's the charge.
Or consent of the FSA.
Each one, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 is disposed of.
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right.
That is correct. Each one of them was disposed of without consent or permission, and that was expressly stated in the agreement, and Dr. Crook signed the agreement. Plus, this property was not owned.
Well, is any violation of a contract like that a criminal violation?
Well, Your Honor, it was done with the intent to defraud the FSA.
And you're saying the jury had it. That intent issue was argued front and center by Dr. Crook.
Oh, Your Honor.
I know.
This was the issue. The trial focused on his knowledge and his intent about the rice and everything.
But if the bank were confused, that would lead some credence to his saying, I thought the bank had the prior position.
The government argued, and I don't remember if this was, I believe it was in some of the hearings on the motion, some of the discussion on the exclusion. The bank changed hands 3 times in this period, and that's why Casey was no longer in Monroe. He was with when the bank was taken over. So it changed hands very quickly, and personnel was changed. And so it can readily be assumed that the bank didn't know what the left hand was doing. The right, they were just not totally aware.
But that's all that comes into evidence. There's still documentary evidence in which the bank thought they were part of the FSA, and they didn't tell.
No, the evidence that defendant tried to put in was that the bank thought that they had
a. And that's relevant.
And that information, much of it was from hearsay from defendant himself, or other hearsay, or just notes made on a sheet.
November letter when he writes to Casey saying you've got the first lien, did that come in or not? Do you know the one I'm talking about?
Yes, I believe it did,
okay.
but I'm not sure.
One letter did come in.
One, yes.
I don't know if it's November or not.
Okay.
One letter did come in. And defendant, in his testimony, he did admit to everything except that he didn't intend. And that was the bottom line for the defendant on his defense. It was all with intent and knowledge. And I call your attention to, and I'll give you some record sites since Judge Jones asked for them, with respect to the Rice. Pages 809 to 810, 814, and 817 in the transcript indicates that Dr. Crook and his father picked up the check from Morehouse Rice and Grain. And that is the recollection of Terrell Hawkins, who said that. And so he knew that this $345,000 for the 45,000 hundredweight of rice, he got the benefit of it. Yet he did not include that in his application for either the loan, the emergency loan, or for the emergency grant.
But he denied that he had picked up the check. Didn't his dad endorse it?
His father endorsed it, and that is incorrectly stated in my brief. I stated that he had, but it was his father, defendant's father, endorsed the check. But there is testimony that defendant and his father together picked up the check.
And your theory, your evidence about that is that although Dr. Crook denies it, he must have flown his plane.
That
to
was.
The bank to the grain elevator and back, and in time to be on duty in the emergency room.
Right. Right. That was a possibility of how he was able to do that. And then he did state in his testimony that he would be on duty for some stretch of time. And there was something he made the reference to unless by agreement with the other person who was coming on. There was some flexibility.
Before your time's up, what is your most?
It's not quite up.
It's not. Okay. What is your most powerful evidence of intent to defraud on counts 3 to 8?
On counts 3 to 8?
Right, because the
defendant's own testimony himself that he knew all of this.
That's your best
and
evidence?
Then, no, that's not the best evidence. The best evidence is Turberville, I think that's the man's name who sold the property, and then the FSA and the documents that say specifically you can't sell this without permission. And then there's a clause in the documents also that says any property that you exchange it for becomes subject to our lien. And this man is not illiterate.
Yes, but again, if they're the second lien holder, I mean, it's not a good thing. But whether the government should really be treating
but the
it
government
as a crime
requires
is
that he get permission before he sells it, so that they can have an opportunity to appraise it.
You still didn't explain to me why it took 10 years to indict him.
Your Honor, I can't answer that question. I'm sorry.
The wheels of justice grind fine.
I guess so, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Underwood.
Your Honor, actually, in the subject of pretrial motion, these Rice counts came up long ago, and the government said they're going to charge him under 18-1001, making a false statement, mm-hmm. not the 1014. We went and spoke to them, and they concluded they couldn't prove their case beyond a reasonable
the
doubt.
The county committee had found that he didn't have the intent or something too, right?
That's correct. Now, when these equipment charges came up later is when they came back and decided, well, maybe we can prove the Rice counts, and they lumped them back in there, and they changed fourths and put it all in there.
Did you agree to extend the statute of limitations here?
We did at one point when we were talking with them, so we don't have a statute argument. But the 1001 had prescribed
right.
1014, and that dovetails into the ex post facto argument, but that's cut and dried on that one. I don't need to waste my time on that.
And he spoke to the agents without a lawyer at the outset, right?
Yes, every time. Every time he spoke with the agents without a lawyer. The statement was made by counsel that Dr. Crook said he didn't care about the FSA and wanted to pay the bank. I don't remember that from any witness anywhere in the proceedings.
The government's brief was noticeably lacking in record references.
Wait, what was the proposition?
She said orally that Dr. Crook told somebody maybe that was selling the equipment that he didn't care about the FSA, he wanted to pay the bank. And I don't remember that testimony anywhere in the record. I don't know what the interest rate of the bank is.
Interest rate evidence wasn't in the record?
It may have been, but I just, off the top of my head, Your Honor, I can't remember y'all were questioning that. There were no efforts from the government to get the money from the bank, zero. They decided to criminally prosecute Dr. Crook rather than go to the bank to get the money and put this over with.
Now, if I remember the closing arguments, though, the government does say, it comes out sort of, the bank's pretty dirty here too, folks. You can assume that, but we're only charging this individual. So that issue of bank complicity was sort of lurking in the case.
It may have been lurking or something that she said at the end, but it was never brought front forward to the jury. They never knew that the bank, what the bank did in this case. But the government made no efforts to get the money from the bank. They simply prosecuted Dr. Crook, and also they stopped any proceedings to get the collateral once they criminally charged him. The agent that testified said he instructed everybody hold off on anything until we get this criminal prosecution done. As far as the sale of equipment, the bank was mentioned every time, and the bank's name was, he told them to put the bank's name on the check when this equipment was sold. It was made out to Bank One and Dr. Crook. He didn't try to get it just to himself, and all the money went to the bank. As far as the, you mentioned briefly the 404B evidence.
Yeah.
I had a hard time with this. I know intent opens Pandora's box to a lot of things, but they spent not only on cross-examination, but witness after witness on this gin and airplane.
But where's the 404B error? I mean, the judge went through it.
I think it's the prejudice that these aren't even, this is totally different from what we're talking about with these tractors that were sold.
There was a lot of emphasis on it.
The fact that he was not the actor that signed the security agreement and put the collateral up, there are just many things that gave me great pause with that decision.
These are important points you're making, and I think we're noting them all, but I still am very, very concerned about the expert. You wouldn't know this case she cited, but isn't it the obligation of a trial court to do always lesser sanctions unless there's a willful disobedience of the discovery?
I believe so, Your Honor. In this case, I told him about the expert. I gave him his CV. They knew the issues. They knew what he was going to test about. It was not some dark secret. And the purpose behind Rule 16 is to not sandbag the other party at trial. And if they request a written expert report or a summary of it, give it to them. And would it have remedied it if I got up from my deathbed when I was sick and gave him a one-paragraph report of what the expert was going to say? That report was a non-issue to me. They knew the expert. They had a CV. They knew what he was going to testify about, yet they threw the whole thing away. They threw his entire testimony out. And for us not have the ability to put on the defense of Dr. Crook succinctly with our own witness and not have to use the hostile witnesses from the government that were against us to try to get out these different facts before the jury, it totally hampered the defense. We could not tie it together, and as I said from the beginning, I think that's why the jury was confused. They were confused with the numbers on the rice and overwhelmed with the documents on the equipment and didn't ever understand what the law really was on that.
All right, we have your argument. Thank you.
Thank you.